You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580, The Information Advantage. Celeste Quinn is away this week. I'm Tom Rogers. Craig Cohen will be your host for tomorrow and Wednesday's Afternoon Magazine. The story of the simple weather map you may see on the Weather Channel or on your TV newscast or the back page of the newspaper is far from simple. In fact, it parallels the history of gauging and forecasting the weather, the scientific trial and error, successes and failures that have led to today's highly researched computer-enhanced maps and graphics that you see most often. Cartographer and author Mark Monmanier has followed up books on mapping news events and even lying with maps with his latest book called Air Apparent, air spelled A-I-R. It's a look at the history of the weather map and where it's come since. Monmanier is a professor of geography at Syracuse University in New York, and you can join the mix as we talk with Mark Monmanier. Our phone numbers here at AM 580 are 333-9455, and outside the Champaign-Urbana area, 1-800-222-9455. Once again, local calls, 333-WILL. Outside the area, 1-800-222-WILL. Mark Monmanier joins us. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Tom. How are you?
Very good. How about you?
Okay, thanks.
What prompted you to make this progression as a person who has written a lot of books on maps to this type of map?
Well, I guess several things. One, I've always had a strong interest in weather. Two, there were some issues that were raised in my book, Cartographies of Danger, where some of the material that I looked at there opened up wider possibilities. And three, about 10 years earlier, when I wrote a book concerned with newspaper maps, I got into the role of weather maps in newspapers. And at that time, I had looked at some documents involving testimony before the U.S. Congress by Weather Bureau personnel. And I was intrigued at that time by the use of weather maps as propaganda. So all three of these things actually came to a point in my decision to write a book concerned with weather maps, plus the fact that this is one area which I think is extremely important, but which very few cartographers have looked into. In fact, I think the only cartographer in recent years who really has looked at weather maps has been Jim Carter at the Illinois State University in Normal.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the interest that brought you to this subject. You do have a little overlap in the book, chapters on how weather spotters track danger, such as environmental problems, spills, that sort of thing, and how they're tracked through the air, and also how newspapers have used weather maps as well. But I'm just sort of curious, how is a weather map used as propaganda?
Well, I guess back around like 1910, it was used very much when Weather Bureau officials were testifying before Congress. At that time, weather maps were printed in, I think, almost 100 different cities. And these maps were printed oftentimes using relatively primitive techniques and also relatively variable data, which is to say that you had some cities where they had a meteorologist who was able to plot a weather map based upon readings, you know, maybe for about 50 or 60 places. You had some others, let's say, where they maybe had to base their map on about 20 places. And the reason for this difference was that back in that time, you had weather maps plotted in all kinds of different places because it was very difficult, if not impossible, to distribute outward, let's say from Washington, D.C., a centrally prepared weather map. And the printing of these maps was rather costly insofar as, with some stations, in fact, the Bureau had to hire more than one full-time printer. In some other places, they had very, very crude weather maps where basically the map was more or less reproduced by using carbon paper. And so when testifying at a hearing, one of the things that Weather Bureau officials were concerned with was not only was the hill appearance of their maps as they would be printed in various places, and they also addressed the issue of accuracy. And if Congress were to appropriate more funds, they claimed, obviously with some justification, they could provide senators, and congressmen's constituents with a far better and presumably more reliable product.
And I'm sure that, that there are other instances where weather maps have been used in congressional hearings and that sort of thing for requesting any number of things since then,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure. We take weather maps for granted, but and you think that they, you know, they followed us through history, but they didn't go back as far as I thought they would when reading the book. How far back do you trace the origin of the weather map?
Well, the first weather map, or I should say, the first weather map which had elements that we think of as constituting a weather map, was presumably prepared about 1816 by a German professor of physics, Heinrich Wilhelm Brandis. And the surprising thing is that Brandis used data that were over 30 years old. When you think of some of the problems of creating a weather map, you have to have data for the same time of day. You have to have these data sent in from a variety of different locations. And when Brandis used data that had been compiled by an organization called the Meteorological Society of the Palatinate, which had a network of about 30 correspondents, mostly in Europe, who would take measurements at roughly the same time of day and using relatively comparable instruments. The strange thing about this is that the members of this group apparently never thought that it would be meaningful to take their data and plot them on a map. They collected these data because they thought that there might be some correlation between weather and certain astronomical phenomena, or between, let's say, weather and the influence locally on like various species of insects and plants. Brandis, being a physicist, theorized that there was a relationship between atmospheric pressure and wind. And he thought that maybe if we were, in fact, able to plot a series of weather maps, we might get a better sense of how the weather operates. An interesting aside here is that Brandis's first weather map has never been found. There have been some people who claim that he didn't do it, but I think he provides a very good description in a letter that he wrote to a physics journal. I think he offered a very clear description of the process. In any case, by the 1820s, we had scientists, or as they called themselves back then, natural philosophers, not only making weather maps, in this case maybe using data that would be only several weeks old, but also debating the origin of storms as to whether, let's say, the flow of air that you have around a circular storm was counterclockwise or was interior toward the center. The surprising thing is that was a fairly vigorous controversy, and in reality, it turns out that both sides were actually right, or at least partly so.
Mm-hmm. So how far was the leap then between just being plotting weather statistics on a map and then using that to talk about the origins of things and maybe forecasting the weather? When did we decide that perhaps, you know, looking at those patterns, that we could see what's going on ahead of time?
Some people had a pretty good idea during the 1850s that weather forecasting would soon be practical. The problem is that in order to forecast weather, you have to get your point measurements to a central point fairly rapidly. And before the electric telegraph, that simply was not possible. They had tried some experiments on Britain, bringing data in by railway, but they had two difficulties there. One, they really didn't have that. They really didn't have that much lead time. And secondly, in order to be able to sense weather in Britain, you would really have to have some indication of conditions out in the North Atlantic. One advantage that the United States had, especially the eastern seaboard as well as midwestern states, is that we had an enormous land territory. And generally, weather systems move from west to east. And by being able to collect measurements from outposts, in other words, weather stations in the western part of the country, they were able to assemble fairly meaningful weather maps. But this really did not occur in a practical way until well after the Civil War. There were some plans that Joseph Henry had before the Civil War of operating a meteorological service out of the Smithsonian Institute, but he just did not have the funds to carry that out after the war itself. There was scientist, an entrepreneur by the name of Cleveland Abey in Cincinnati, who also had the idea, and he was able to convince Western Union to have the operators, to have telegraph operators, when they signed on, to forward some relatively straightforward weather measurements. But he really didn't get that many stations. But what he did do was to demonstrate, in an operational sense, the possibility of having timely weather forecasts. And Abey's demonstration was important because in 1870, the U.S. Congress decided to set up a weather bureau in the Army Signal Office, which is now the Army Signal Corps. And for roughly about 20 years, the Weather Bureau operated as a kind of military service, even though they distributed forecasts to the civilian population. It turned out, however, that they really weren't that good at it, and in 1891, the Bureau itself was transferred to the Department of Agriculture as a civilian agency.
Now, how was it that they were transmitted in those times? Were the newspapers quick to catch on to that, or were there other ways that they disseminated the information?
Well, newspapers didn't really catch on that rapidly. I mean, there was an article I found that I think was published about 1904. And at that time, someone had identified four newspapers that were currently publishing weather maps. And this probably reflects the initiative of either editors in these four cities or perhaps maybe Weather Bureau personnel. But around 1912, the director of the Weather Bureau, who was trying to cut costs, and in fact he was under enormous pressure from the Congress to try and rein in the costs of operating a bureaucracy which for that time was really huge. And in looking over his budget, one of the things that became quite obvious is that the Weather Bureau really had a lot of printers on its staff. And somebody had the idea, well, okay, maybe if we can just provide a nice clear copy or perhaps maybe even printing plates, we could get newspapers in these areas to print our weather map. And this would have two advantages. One advantage, of course, it would reduce the Weather Bureau's payroll, but also it would greatly increase the circulation of what they refer to as the daily weather map. So they undertook a program to attract newspapers by providing either a very crisp black and white copy, which could then be used by the newspaper's photographic engravers to prepare a press plate for printing. Or, in some cases, the Weather Bureau itself was even able to provide local papers with a printing block. And when doing this, they've recruited newspapers to their cause. Unfortunately, they ran into some cost problems as a result of the First World War, and a lot of newspapers dropped it, and then they started to pick it up once again rather slowly and sporadically during the 1920s. But the really significant subsequent breakthrough occurred around 1935, when the Associated Press installed its wire photo network. And this was a telegraphic network which had dedicated lines where they could move photographs, principally news photographs, to subscribing newspapers. And at that time, I think they only had about 30 newspapers, even though several hundred were Associated Press members. They only had about 30 subscribers to the wire photo service. But what they were able to do was to include two weather maps along with the photos that they would move. And I think this really showed a significant interest in weather, because at that time, it took about 7 minutes to transmit a weather map. So the weather maps were actually in competition with lots of other news photos. But weather information, by the same token, was quite timely.
And it certainly saved the Weather Bureau a lot of money, obviously.
Well, it did. But ultimately, I mean, Associated Press members picked up wire photo service. Plus, at that point, a competing press service, United Press International. In fact, before that, its predecessor, United Press, they set up their own photo wire service, and they also used weather maps. Mm-hmm. So we were able to get centrally produced weather maps out to local papers relatively inexpensively.
Mm-hmm. Mark Momineer is our guest on the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of Air Apparent, How Meteorologists Learn to Map, Predict, and Dramatize the Weather. Mark Momineer is a cartographer, and he joins us from Syracuse University. Our numbers, once again, if you have any questions for our guest, are 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana. Elsewhere, 1-800-222-9455. I'd like to go back to around the time when the telegraph first made the almost instantaneous transmission of weather data possible. It must have been quite an accomplishment just to get all those people together, set up the stations, make sure that they're standardized and they're using the same types of equipment and getting the same kinds of readings, and do it all at one time. How difficult was that in getting all that together?
That was an enormous task, and obviously it didn't happen all at one time. What we had to start out with was a relatively rudimentary network, and gradually they were able to make some improvements in it. One thing I think which is interesting to note is that the Weather Bureau itself even operated some of its own telegraph lines, because they wanted to get measurements out of coastal places which were not serviced by the commercial telegraph network.
Mm-hmm. What in tandem with the development of the weather map and the technology that was used to make the maps, there were also some things that were, invented simply for that purpose, things like the weather kites and balloons and that sort of thing. And how much of that is in use today, if anything?
Well, these days they still use balloons in some places, mm-hmm. although these are nowhere near as important as they used to be. But late in the 19th century, Weather Bureau people were well aware of the fact that the upper atmosphere really held a lot of clues to surface weather. And one of the problems that they had, of course, is that all of their measurements were based upon instruments which were on the ground. They could look up and they could identify different kinds of clouds, and they could see the direction and speed at which clouds were moving. But in terms of being able to directly sample pressure and temperature, they were restricted to ground situations. Well, in order to get a better sense of what was going on, they decided to probe the upper atmosphere, and they had amazing approaches that they had was the development of some huge box kites. And these had to be very large because they wanted to do two things. They wanted to reach great heights, and they wanted also to loft upward a package of instruments with a mechanical recorder. In other words, they had a piece of graph paper that was mounted on a drum, and it was driven by a clock-like mechanism. And they were able to use this to record pressure, temperature, and several other things. And they had a number of weather stations, but relatively few because this was largely experimental at that point, where they could get these kites up to altitudes, in some cases more than a mile. The only thing is it took time. You had to reel it out, and then you had to reel it back. And there are also problems because if you had a day where there wasn't much wind, you were sort of out of luck. Balloons also worked, and they experimented with tethered balloons. In the 1920s, they also used a device known as the radio sonde, where they sent up a free-flying balloon which had a radio transmitter as well as instruments. And they were able to track these things, and they were able to send their measurements down to the ground in a fairly timely way. But one thing I think which was also important is the recognition of weather fronts. The theory of air mass of air mass circulation was developed by a team of Norwegian meteorologists, mm-hmm. and this happened shortly after.
We have to say to the audience that you've got a bit of a scratchy throat this afternoon.
Oh, my God, I don't normally sound like that.
Under the weather, so to speak.
That's right. but the theory of weather fronts was developed in the early 1920s. And one of the things which was useful here is that they were able to hypothesize what the weather was like at higher altitudes by extrapolating upward from surface measurements.
Mm-hmm. And using those inventions, obviously.
That's right. Now, for the longest time, and when I say the longest time, this was well into the 1930s, the United States Weather Bureau was extraordinarily skeptical of it.
Of the use of fronts.
Of the use of fronts. They didn't want to have fronts on their weather maps. They didn't really think that there was much to this idea of air mass circulation. And it was only because of the needs of aviators who were very much concerned with timely weather information that the Weather Bureau was forced to hire some new personnel who were able to put air mass analysis into operation. One of the problems was that they had a rather scientifically or intellectually conservative old guard that simply was used to doing things the old way. And the old way was largely a matter of looking at storm centers and tracking storm centers and trying to figure out what the weather would be like just by the general movement of highs and lows, which up to a point worked. but you could get a far more accurate picture if you were able to look at fronts. Nowadays, of course, we have meteorologists, some of whom are fairly skeptical of the idea of weather fronts.
It just seems like something that you take for granted when you look at a weather map. I mean, you seem to think that the fronts have been there all the time, but obviously there's still some controversy about what significance they play.
That's right. And, of course, one of the problems, too, with fronts is that the typical maps that we look at just show you surface fronts.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have some fronts which will exist at higher altitudes which do not have any surface expression. One thing I think that everybody who agrees is that the upper atmosphere is able to yield some extremely important maps. Important maps which show you high-level circulation patterns which are extremely influential in steering surface storms. And it's fairly common, let's say, for a meteorologist to plot something that's called the 500 millibar surface, which basically shows you the locations of highs and lows, but these are very different from the highs and lows that we have on our surface weather maps. The upper atmosphere maps tend to be considerably more generalized, but they can be very revealing as to the kinds of weather that one might have.
You also mentioned talking about the steps that the milestones that have been passed in the advancement of weather maps, the dawn of the computer age, and how they've been able to help forecasting and map plotting. And you also mentioned that they gave some credibility to a theory of a numerical theory of meteorology that had sort of been laughed off when it was first proposed with Lewis Richardson?
That's right. This was proposed in the mid-1920s by a British philosopher, mathematician, social worker by the name of Lewis Fry Richardson. And Richardson had a rather grandiose idea that it would be possible to divide the world up into a number of grid cells, which were operationally, I guess, fairly large grid cells. And the idea was that each grid cell had weather that was influenced by the weather in neighboring grid cells. And he was concerned with being able to estimate the influence of each grid cell on its neighbor in terms of the exchange of air, the exchange of heat, moisture, and so forth. And his idea was that by having a very, very large number of calculations where you look at reverse influences, where you look, for instance, at the effect of one cell on its neighboring cell, and that cell's effects on its other neighbors, and then ultimately these effects would be transmitted back to the first cell, and this process could go on and on and on with lots and lots of calculations. But Richardson even wrote a book on this, and in fact he described a situation rather tongue-in-cheek in which there was a large concert hall, and you had people doing calculations, and they would exchange these calculations with their neighbors. He also tried out an example, a relatively small example. He had to make some rather simplifying assumptions, and these calculations took him several months, and they were wrong, really wrong, almost to the point of no embarrassment.
You were talking about, variations of, tens, even sometimes more than 100 degrees at times.
Something in that order.
Yeah.
I think the problem was that his calculations showed some extraordinarily high wind speeds.
Mm-hmm. So when the computer came along and people were able to use that to carry out some of the numerical calculations that and keep them in order, that in the end, his theories are they still used to this day in forecasting and plotting things?
Well, basically, his principles are the fundamental basis of what modern meteorological models are all travel about.
Mm-hmm.
What we have, of course, is an enormous refinement of the process. We have faster computing machines. We have a much larger number of measurements. We're able to divide the atmosphere up into multiple layers. And the reason for this is that what's necessary, not only just to have these cells, but to recognize that each cell is best treated as a kind of sandwich, where we have different layers in the atmosphere, so that we have exchange, exchanges not only with the cell's neighbors on each side, but with the cell which is above and below. When forecasting, also, of course, is able to incorporate different theories, and as a result, we have different forecast models which sometimes do not agree with each other.
Yeah, we have a meteorologist here on staff, and he talks about in his longer forecasts, you know, using the European model and other models to track weather over the short and long term. So there are different types of things that they use.
Uh-huh.
How explain what a European model is?
I'm not really certain exactly what that term means.
But there are just different competing types of models that are still in use.
There are different European weather services,
mm-hmm.
and each weather service publishes a series of models. And I would imagine, let's say, that Britain's Meteorological Office would be using models which would be somewhat different from those that are used by the U.S. Weather Bureau. And so I think that probably is what he is referring to.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that there's a great deal of difference in terms of the underlying basic science.
Right.
What is interesting, though, is a process that has been used about 5 years or so, called ensemble forecasting. And the idea here simply is that you use a variety of different models and you run them forward in time and you see how much similarity you have. And where you have a lot of similarity, in those cases you can probably estimate that you have a result that's fairly predictable. Where you have a great deal of difference between the various models in your ensemble, there you have a situation where there's considerably more uncertainty. Obviously, too, as you run these models further and further forward in time, the whole amount of uncertainty that you're going to wind up with becomes greater and greater. Nowadays, they have weather forecasts that can look ahead several days.
Mm-hmm.
People would like to be able to look ahead a lot further. Generally speaking, though, it seems that the outer limit, really pushing it, might be somewhere on the order of about 2 weeks.
And it's taken a long time to get that far.
That's right. Well, I mean, I don't suppose we can really say that we are that far.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, if you look at these relatively longer range forecasts, what you find is that they become vaguer and vaguer. In other words, if you have a 36-hour forecast, that forecast is probably going to tell you what kind of weather you're going to have in a certain place 36 hours ahead of time. It'll try to tell you what the pressure might be, what the temperature might be, what the probability of precipitation is, what kind of sky cover that you're likely to have. When you look ahead 2 weeks, you're looking at a period that's inherently more vague, and it would generally tend to tell you that you're going to have maybe temperatures that would be somewhat warmer than normal, or somewhat less than normal for that time of year, or maybe you would just expect to have temperatures which would be in a kind of normal range. And the same thing for precipitation. There have been some forecasters whom professional meteorologists treat with a lot of contempt as well as skepticism, who claim to be able to forecast what the weather is going to be like roughly about a year ahead of time.
Uh-huh. Sort of the old farmer's almanac types.
Even more precise than the farmer's almanac.
Uh-huh.
And the fact is, of course, these forecasts, a certain percentage of the time, will be right. And, of course, there's some parts of the country, you know, where in certain times of the year, let's say if you're out in Arizona, you can probably get by reasonably well by forecasting that it's going to be sunny and dry.
Hot and dry, of course.
That's right.
But obviously, those probabilities go down as the term gets longer. But even though I guess the Weather Bureau uses sometimes longer term forecasting.
Uh-huh.
Our guest again, Mark Montminier. He is the author of the book Air Apparent: A Look at the History and Development of the Weather Map. He is at Syracuse University. Our numbers, again, if you have questions, we have about 10 minutes left in the show. Our numbers, 333-WILL in Champaign-Urbana, 1-800-222-WILL outside the Champaign-Urbana area. We look at maps and we see the symbols and the the fronts that are drawn with lines and then the symbols on them. And when you look at some of the professional weather maps that, their true form may not make it to the maps that we're used to seeing in the media, they have symbols on them too. Where do those symbols come from? How did we come to symbolize fronts with those types of lines and the feather type apparatus on some of the locations that gauge wind speed and direction, that sort of thing? How did that all come to be? That was before the weather map that you had mentioned.
There, in fact, were some symbols which were used to represent local weather that had been published by the Meteorological Society of the Palatinate, which had published the data that were used by Brandes when making his weather map. They used a few small symbols like that simply to provide a graphic summary of their data. Oddly, though, they did not represent them in cartographic form. Other weather symbols evolved over time. From the standpoint, different countries tried different things. You will find that, let's say, in the late 19th century, British weather maps look somewhat different from more American weather maps.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to different European countries, there were also differences there. If you had symbols, let's say, which used abbreviations, American weather maps oftentimes for certain stations would have a little circle, and that little circle might have an R or an S inside it. The R would represent rain, the S would represent snow.
Right.
If conditions were cloudy, they would fill the circle in, let's say, it would be blackened in. If the situation was partly cloudy, they would have half the circle blackened in. So there was a kind of a graphic logic involved here, as well as the straightforward nature of abbreviations. Arrows seemed to be fairly natural, and of course they were inherited from some earlier graphic symbols. One thing that was also useful were curved lines that represented equal value, so-called isolines. And of course, if you have isolines that represent temperature, these are called isotherms. On climatological maps, they have isolines representing rainfall, isohyets, and of course for atmospheric pressure, isobars. And it was extremely important to have isobars because these basically were able to show you the configuration of the pressure surface. You would have circular isobars that might be surrounding an area where you had relatively low pressure, and presumably in the center there you would have a center of low pressure, which was oftentimes associated with stormy activity. High pressure centers were also important. And as people learned to read weather maps, they recognized, in fact, that you could have such a thing as a blocking high, which is to say that if you had certain areas where you had very dominant high pressure, generally storms, which were centers of low pressure, would tend to stay away from them.
Mm-hmm. We have time for a brief phone call on line one from Urbana. Good afternoon. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
I heard this morning, and the person was basing it on sunspots, and I think it was on one of the radio stations, and they said that he had been accurately predicting the cyclones, etc., and the prediction now was for a mild winter and a very dry, like a drought, next spring for the farmers. Now, that may have been covered by someone before I turned on the radio.
I believe, yeah, having heard a little of that this morning, that was the Old Farmer's Almanac that does that, bases some of their predictions on sunspots or sunspot activity. Is there anything in the book that covers that at all? Or has any of that theory been used in the prediction of weather before?
Sunspots, I know a lot of people have had an interest in sunspots. Meteorologists generally tend to ignore them, except for the fact that there is an association with the amount of solar energy, which can have somewhat of an influence. But I think if one wants to really get a good idea of future weather, there is a website that is maintained by the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, where they have some long-range climatological forecasts where they can estimate somewhat vaguely the precipitation and temperature patterns that you're going to have by month, 13 months ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the best that they think they can do at this point. And also, they are fairly vague. And so I think that most people who are in scientific meteorology, when they see the almanac come up with a forecast where you have, let's say, June 16, 17, 18, and 19, and it says rain, well, on the one hand, there's a question of what science underlies that, and the answer, probably is none. The other thing is that forecast right if you have rain on any one of those 4 days?
Mm-hmm.
And this is really, almost equally vague.
It's a matter of interpretation, I'm sure.
That's right.
Thanks for your call. And the book also covers the development of weather maps through the use of satellites and radar and today's equipment and the ways that we're able to see maps through anything from television to the Internet, a bunch of sites that you can also go to for the latest weather maps. And it's a very interesting book. The title is, once again, Air Apparent, How Meteorologists Learn to Map, Predict, and Dramatize the Weather. Mark Monmanier has been our guest this afternoon, and unfortunately, we've run out of time. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
The book, again, Air Apparent, AIR, spelled air, and it comes from the University of Chicago Press.